Now, our next speaker, delighted that Peter's here. Some of you will know him, others will not. If I may introduce Peter briefly, he's Canon, or Reverend Canon Peter Challen, great spirit, Canon Emeritus of the Diocese of Southwark, moderator of the Open Global Table on Inclusive Monetary Justice, chair of the Christian Council for Monetary Justice, and Sloan Fellow of the London Business School. I've known Peter for a while, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, people will be sharing their lifetime work, but it's also a challenge to compress it, and I'm sure Peter will be delighted to do so. Over to you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. May peace be upon this assembly as we seek to respond to the universal laws under which we are all governed, the laws of God, of love, of reciprocity. A few years ago, I was travelling with a four-year-old grandson, and I pointed to some tiny, tiny figures on the bridge a long way off and said, "Why are those people so small?" And the four-year-old said, "Because we are so distant." And I was puzzled by that. It's not the way I would have responded, I think. So I asked the four-year-old what he meant, and he said, "However far away they are still the same size. They are people." Now, buried in that is a tremendously powerful theological idea that every human being, indeed every life form on this planet, under natural law, under the amazing creation, however it has occurred, the dignity of every life form and its pattern in reciprocity, in mutuality, is there. All that we've heard this morning, I think, is undermining that. And we have to move forward. And that's why my title is Nothing Short of a Proposal That Works for Everyone and Protects the Earth. That's my mantra. What works for everyone and protects the earth? Nothing short of that. In the Royal Society of Arts Journal that came to me yesterday, the Royal Society of Arts, Commerce, and what's the third one? Trade, I think. 50,000 fellows in this country are members of the RSA, and one of the headlines in that journal that came yesterday was that the balance of thinking is moving towards big, inclusive, rather than piecemeal thinking. Now, we are subject to globalization. People protest against its ill. You mustn't overlook its good. And thus, I want to make a very short proposal for a positive idea represented and written up with great thoroughness by Rodney Shakespeare in this book, but developed and wrestled with week after week after week at the Open Global Table that meets here in London and has done for 12 years. A focus for thought on these issues, a focus for the encouragement of people to take what steps they can from where they start to effect fundamental change. Something should have changed and it hasn't. Can you tell me why? Sorry. Well, we're aware that banks are shuddering. We've heard so much about these things this morning, that mortgages are disappearing, that stock markets are trembling. And the evidence of damage expands daily. I open my website every morning and look on the internet, and it's unbelievable. In the last few months, the evidence of the damage is coming from within the system. People at very senior levels in this country, in the States, and elsewhere are calling at last for structural change, exposing that for many years, as danger has threatened, we've been dealing with symptoms. Climate change, a massive symptom. Huge numbers of people now caught up in dealing with that symptom. Almost none of them are examining the underlying monopolistic, powerful drivers of which we heard so much evidence this morning, the way in which that's degrading the whole of our society. So in the last few weeks, information has begun to come before us that deep structural faults lie in the system and must be remedied in what a great thinker called the fierce urgency of now. I grow a little impatient when I hear people saying one of two things. One, I'm not an economist. What human being doesn't care about housekeeping? Every one of us is a jobbing economist. Don't let anyone say to you, I'm not an economist. Challenge them. Help them to see that their ignorance, their innocent question, their different perspective to the experts, that is important for the discovery of what a true housekeeping of this global human family of all life forms really is. So with a fierce urgency of now, deal with that, with your questions. And the other thing people keep saying, oh, this is going to take a time, it's going to evolve over the 10, 15, 20 years. I don't believe with that sort of time. The fierce urgency of now, we have to act. And that's why I want to propose an idea that arises because the present economic system does not do any of these things. And they've all been represented with massive passion in the speeches we've already heard. It does not avoid economic cycles. It does not avoid build-up of cycles into even bigger ones. It does not prevent the obscene rich-poor division. I saw just this morning in that same RSA journal that Philip Green, to whom Tariq has just defined, got 1.2 billion income in 1 year. And because his wife lives in Monaco, he doesn't pay a penny in tax. How obscene can the situation be? It does not ensure that producers and consumers are the same people. A vital, vital aspiration of true economics. It does not solve global poverty. Listen to David speaking about his life in India. Walk into those streets that Lindsay mentioned earlier. We are well aware of the gross obscenity of poverty in a rich world. It does not provide social and economic justice. It does not address the major problems of the environment. So what can be proposed? What does this book set up as a case study for serious critique? Not a quick glance and a dismissal on the prejudice of one way you use a word where possibly the word's being used differently in this book. This merits very serious examination. I've got 3 copies only available if anyone wants to purchase one at £10, but you can order more through Amazon. I do say we have to look at something that we could promote in the urgency, the fierce urgency of now. And it would deal with these things, is our argument. The system proposed in the modern universal paradigm offers capital ownership for all so that the produce, and thus earning, independently of whether or not they also have a conventional job. This deals with the issue that everybody is seeking to hold employment in this enslaved situation. What we want theologically, philosophically, humanly, is that everyone feels the dignity of making a contribution, not necessarily with a cash nexus. Think of all those amazing things that people do without cash nexus, without which our human lives would not develop and prosper in the best possible ways. The system proposed offers genuinely free markets, and we've heard so much this morning about the way what is called a free market economy is by no means free, whether it's all those outlets for Philip Green on one level of the Mall, or all the other examples that you can think of. This system offers efficient wealth creation, balancing supply and demand, a very delicate and vital and important task in economic activity. It offers structural economic and social justice. It offers no inflation. It offers proper encouragement of small and start-up businesses. It offers sharing and participatory structures. It offers strong ethical sense, imbuing everything. I looked at an amazing website called ethicalleadership.com yesterday. Wonderful website for examining a whole lot of different pages what it would be to have a true universal ethical system governing our servant leadership in society. The system proposed offers an end to RIBA interest beyond transparent transactional fees. And of course, we must always allow that there's some small 1-2% or something may well be important transparent transaction costs. But interest, usury, must be and can be achieving actually in abolishing it a far greater efficiency and far lower cost in everything that we utilize in our economy. It would end economic colonialism, and it would give support for public and environmental capital projects. At the Bali conference recently, there was a cry from the Director General of the United Nations, or before the Bali conference, for it to be debated, a cry for a financial system that would allow the billions and billions of pounds to become available that the third world, and indeed the whole world, needs to counter the terrible degradations that the history we've been hearing about has been accruing over recent years. And we submitted this proposal, and it's still being thought about by the Director General of the United Nations. The system proposed offers direct connection between money and the real economy. It also offers increase in political freedoms and so deepening of democracy. It offers policy that unites inhabitants of different linguistic, religious, geographical and ethnic backgrounds. Go back to my grandsons. Those people are only small because we have put them at a distance. Everyone, everywhere, all life forms have their dignified contribution within the amazing creative system of which we are part. The only thing you and I all here have in common, utterly, is our Earth identity, our prior unity. And the greatest thing we could have is a conscious movement together, cooperatively, mutually, in trust, with reliable, transparent honesty, moving forward to a common consciousness. And thus, every system that we propose and debate and examine, and this is one put up for it, such examination, must be about inclusive justice on the global scale. Quite a lot of proposals that are coming forth, and there are varieties of them around to be examined, start locally. And if you look closely, the danger is that inside them, consciously or unconsciously, are deep local vested interests. We cannot begin with a psyche the size of our souls. We cannot begin now with our own institutional vested interests. We can only now find a paradigm that is inclusive in its justice for all life forms on Earth. Without that, I don't think we can avert the incredibly rapidly approaching dangers. And this proposal offers, in particular, over time, central bank issued interest-free loans free with freer government from increasing national debt and enable the ownership of an economy to remain in local hands. And all this is summarized in this chart, and it's rather important to notice about it a number of things. Just quickly, that all the flows in this system are reciprocal. They're loans that are repaid. They're loans that are repaid. If you examine, and it's in the current news at the moment, if you look for it, if you examine the vast experiment of the Grameen Bank, it's now self-contained. It's a totally reciprocal system. It took a while to build up. It needed certain kinds of investment. But now that it's a totally self-contained system, feeding encouragement, the ability to contribute in society to millions of people, it's a huge-scale development. We look here in this scheme, which I can't go to in detail, that the central bank issuing money, loaning it into the Grameen Bank, could extend what that has done amazingly in some developing countries for poor people who still have a village concept, who still understand cooperation, who still understand the discipline of using money, who still understand shame if you let each other down. That's the strength of the Grameen Bank, and it's not transferable easily to the Western system. We are looking through this system, which could be explained in depth in this book, to the way in which this could be expanded into the whole economy. And I now try to sum that up in terms of all we've heard from John here about the destructive, competitive manifestation so gross in war throughout the world, and threatening now when all sorts of new wars lie ahead for water, for food, etc. And one of the dangers is that people so easily, as the threat grows, deal with the things in red. And I call these secondary symptoms. They're dealing with climate change, with species loss, with rampant growth, with poverty and societal insecurity, with forest loss, with desertification. Very, very few people are really deeply examining the structural faults of narrow land and asset ownership, of corporate law, of our complicity. And underlying all of these, as we've heard so strongly and we will continue to hear today, is usurious debt-based money system. This is structurally totally at fault and must be changed. And just final words about that wholeness that that little four-year-old right at the beginning understood. Wherever they are on the face of this earth, people are significant. Each and every person is significant. And we must find a system, a way of housekeeping, an economy that gives dignity to every single individual. And that's people of all faith. That's what this symbol is about, on the left. All faith and good faith. I have someone who writes to me regularly from America and signs her emails, brothers and sisters in humanity first. Brothers and sisters in the great traditions that have brought us to that understanding. That seems to me to sum up the way in which the contributions of all the great faiths and all people of good faith, whether from any tradition or not, we find our common humanity, and that requires of us a mutual economic system, transparent, honest, genuinely free, and giving dignity to all contributors. And we'll only understand this if we examine everything we think and everything we do in the dimensions of the whole universe. And I've been saying for many years, everything we think about and every act we have must be tested against its intimate impact, its corporate impact, and its global impact. And unless you oscillate between all those three aspects of our Earth identity, then you will slip consciously or probably unconsciously into the defense of vested interests, not the interest of the globe itself. And I think finally all this depends on our understanding of levels of wealth. We're almost totally subsumed now into an economic system that thinks the only kind of wealth is tradable. John Ruskin said, real life is the only wealth, wealth itself. Life itself is wealth. And here we say there are all sorts of wealth that are only acknowledgeable. Relationships between systems, friendship, love, beauty, freedom, civility, culture, consciousness. And then there are some aspects of wealth that are measurable, properties of systems as a whole, health, diversity, education, attention, strength, vitality, productive capacity. And a small item in the whole economy is tradable. Components of systems, resources, goods, services, time. We've built a false economy entirely on that which is tradable and not even tradable honestly. We have to recover that view of wealth and work on definite, deeply researched proposals for effective change of inclusive justice, not the protection of vested interests. Thank you.
Well, what can I say about that presentation? A couple of points. The passion spoke for itself. The vision was there in reality. And I think this is where Christian-Muslim dialogue needs to get to. Not what do you believe in, what do I believe in? How do you pray? How do you pray? Come on, let's get real. This is where an interfaith dialogue needs to get to. Addressing the real issues out there. Addressing common humanity. I think that's an indirect message there. We have got one of the Christian visionaries, if not leaders, of the city. And I'm delighted your vision has been recorded for posterity and inshallah disseminated much widely through satellite TV. Thank you, Peter. And if Dawood can take the baton, the beacon of light, which we need to travel. Great pleasure to have Dawood Musa Pidcock here. What can I say about Dawood? Take me all day. he's travelled firstly from India, to come here today. So it just shows you, unless we sacrifice time, money, effort, nothing's going to happen. And also, Dawood is a founder director. I'll just introduce him in that capacity, which he is probably known. Founder director of the Islamic Party of Britain, and he's disclosed to me.
Shalom aleikum, peace be with you, namaste, ni hao, everybody, we are brothers and sisters in one world. I realize we have little time, so I'll try to go through things quickly. As you can see, this particular paper relates to Iran at the moment, and one saying of the Prophet was saying that a time will come when holding your faith will be like holding on to a burning ember. The genius of Satan lies in his ability to convince half the world he doesn't exist and the other half that they're not following him, particularly when it comes to monetary policies. J.K. Galbraith confirms this. The study of money above all other fields in economics is the one in which complexity is used to disguise the truth or to evade the truth, not to reveal it. Money from whence it came and where it went. Trojan horse, as it's mentioned, relates to interest and legal tender, which eventually becomes lethal tender. Now, Iran had a number of central bankers, all endorsed by the Federal Reserve, and also Eddie George, governor of the Bank of England. And I was just going to refer here to that Jesus said, by their fruits you will know them. Now it's more a case of by their roots you will know them. In India and Iran, you find people drive like demented beings. And in Tehran, I asked the taxi driver why this was the case, where in a country that has 5,000 years of civilization, very good manners, etc., why do they become demonic when they get behind the steering wheel of a car or the handlebars of a motorcycle? And he said, as a taxi driver, he said, the problem is that the people are all suffering from debt and the fear of debt. So the ones who are rushing are trying to earn money to pay the usurer, the sudwala, and the others are trying not to become like them. So they're looking to protect their interests and their wealth. So that everybody's rushing about. And Imam Ali said this, that we withstood the weight, the iron, the stone, and the lash, but could not endure the burden of debt. So debt is impossible, even for the Prophet's family. Now, a Trojan horse was built by Odysseus and the king of Ithaca. And how did he gain entry into the Trojan city? He built a horse called a Trojan horse. In this case, we have an interest system, usury system. But once you adopt it, you will self-destruct. The only time that Bani Israel, the Israelites, could lend money at interest is where they could not defeat another nation by force of arms. Therefore, if you wish to destroy a nation, particularly your own, you would allow them to lend money at interest, and this will destroy the society. It's happened in the Islamic world, it's happened in the Sudan, where you had Murabaha, and people were paying 76% interest on the Murabaha. So this was absolute madness raised to an art form. Of course, it produces financial AIDS, acquired investment deficiency syndrome. And this is Mr. Eddie George endorsing delightfully the governor of the central bank of Iran, Mohsen Norbakhsh, and actually saying how well he was doing. Now, if the devil tells you you're doing well, then start to think. So we have lethal tender, and I'm going through this quickly because Eddie George, of course, I engaged in him with him a number of times, a long conversation by letters which we are publishing. But this is what he was confirming and endorsing that Iran was doing then. This is 2000. Exchange control would be further loosened, and it is planned that price distortions due to subsidies will also decline. And these are ambitions and wide-ranging plans, and the key is now implementation. So once you have somebody saying that you can either have guns or butter, as people tell us, and you have Eddie George telling us that this is a good system. Now, since that time, Iran, as I was there last month, the rate of interest is accepted at 36%, but in most cases you're paying 5% per month, as a result of which it's like the Grand Prix of Tehran or wherever else you go, people are driving, trying to keep afloat rather than sinking. Thank you, Eddie George. Enter Banquo II. Banquo, Sharia-based finance bans usury rather than interest. We should avoid usury but welcome interest. Now, this is a very great man. This is the new guy who is taken over as the central banker of Iran. And he wants to take advantage of a wide range of variety of modern financial instruments, including interest. Now, this has been around for 5,000 years, to the best of our knowledge. It ain't new. But we know the results. Usury leads to penury. Yes. This is interesting. This is the Financial Times, and it is on World Report. Now, the bank chief takes a realistic tack. But look at the right-hand side. Unfortunately, here we have the Israelis saying that they are going to make a preemptive strike against Iran. Now, if you agree with interest, then expect war from Allah and the Israelis. Because they are his instrument. Understand that whatever happens, God sends he sent the people against the Israelites because they were endorsing the same thing. So whether it's 3,000 years or 2008, the problem is the same. Expect war from Allah and his messenger. This is the letter I sent, an open letter to Ayatollah Khamenei, in which I'm pointing out that when he calls for the Ummah to generate waves of wrath in the wake of Saturday's atrocious attacks by the Zionist regimes in the Gaza Strip, in which dozens of innocent people fell as martyrs, and the renewal threat from Israel to launch a unilateral preemptive strike to stop Iran's nuclear program. Now, this was the irony of that article. Now, David Ben-Gurion, who was the first Prime Minister of Israel, who said he didn't believe in God but thought God believed in him, this was his prediction in 1962. And this tape or this slide, it's all been left here, but David Ben-Gurion predicted what would happen by 1987. He said, by 1987, the Cold War will be a thing of the past. I'll quickly go through it. And he then goes on to say the Soviet Union will be dismantled and become a democratic state. Europe would become a socialist state, having a socialist democratic regime. The United States would become a welfare state with a planned economy. And after the debacle in Iraq, this is what we're heading for. He said a pill to prevent pregnancy would slow down the rapid increase in India and China. And by 1987, of course, world government would be established in Jerusalem, this as according to Isaiah. Now, on the right-hand side is the Israeli newspaper saying that in 2003, 23rd of July, that Shimon Peres called for Jerusalem to be made the world capital. This is exactly what Ben-Gurion was predicting, and is exactly what we're seeing now. And all these are related in prophecy from Christian, Jewish, and Islamic sources. So, but Mikhail Gorbachev, or Missile Gorbachev, was there in 1987 because he was brought to power to dismantle the Soviet Union. It had served its purpose. Mm-hmm. But where was Trotsky in 1917? And you'll understand who financed the Bolshevik Revolution. It was the Americans, of course, the bankers in Wall Street, along with the bankers in London. And so all the things are happening according to a program. Nothing happens by accident, as Ken will tell you. Roosevelt said nothing happens by accident. If it happens, it was planned to happen. So here we have the situation as it is now. There is a program. Yes, we're all conspiracy theorists, but unfortunately the facts speak for themselves. This is St. Ambrose speaking on Deuteronomy on the point that I was making a little earlier. Where there is a right of interest, there is also a right of war. And Thomas Jefferson and the prophet's cousin Ali, peace be upon him, Ali said, if poverty were a man, I would kill him. And we withstood the weight of the iron, stone, and the lash. Thomas Jefferson is then saying, the modern theory for the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating. War is an essential component of the economy. Now, Abraham Lincoln, this is what he said a year before they killed him. Think about Bear Stearns, Northern Rock, etc. I see in the future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption will follow. And the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until wealth is aggregated into a few hands and the public destroyed. A year later, after he said money will cease to be master and become the servant of humanity, they're shot in 3 days later. And we find this historically from the last 5,000 years, from 2400 BC, the history that I'm finishing for Mr. Swan, who was locked up under Regulation 18B for 5 years during the war, for pointing out that the governor of the Bank of England, Montague Norman, and Prescott Bush and Herbert Walker, President Bush's grandparents, were the main financiers of Hitler. And he was locked up for actually saying that. So we have freedom from speech, not freedom of speech. Ruskin, of course, the great debater, and he is saying when there was a massive debate in England at the time of his greatness, he was then criticised by the Bishop Manchester, when in actual fact he was criticising the Bishop of Manchester. And he is pointing out what he meant by usury, what he meant by interest. What I mean by usury, I trust your lordship will at once acquit me of wishing to attach any other significance to the word than that which was fully intended to be conveyed on every use of its, occasion of its use by Moses, by David, by Christ, and the doctors of the Christian church down to the 17th century. It is neither justified by its defenders only in its mildness, nor condemned by its accusers only in its severity. Usury, or its commercial euphemism interest, in any degree is asserted by the church to be sinful, just as theft and adultery are asserted to be sinful, though neither may have been accompanied by violence. And although the theft may have been on the most splendid scale and the fornication of the most courtly refinement. So also in the modern days, 1879, again, modern theories again. Modern is always what happens. This will be modern, but it will be history in the future if we live that long. And J.C. Hubbard, who was an MP sponsored by the Bank of England, because many of the MPs are sponsored by the financial institutions. Every Prime Minister since 1694 has been in office but never in power. Understand that the Prime Ministers are elected just to take the heat, but the city is the government, and everybody plays out the game. So Ruskin is saying also the voice of the Bank of England in Parliament, MC J.C. Hubbard, who declares a loan without interest to be a monster, and a monster may, and a loan made below the current rate of interest to be a monster in its degree. On the other hand, the increase of dividends above the current rate is not, as far as I am aware, being shunned by shareholders with an equally religious horror. Now, this is the importance. Now, Imam Ghazali, in the Islamic world, from the 12th century, he was an Iranian, and I pointed this out to Mr. Khamenei, that that not all Iranians didn't understand money. Imam Ghazali did understand money, and Ruskin understands money probably better than anyone. So, this is the point. For Muslims, Jews, Christians, as Muhammad Rafiq will tell you, the whole idea of lending is to please God. You're lending to Him, you're not lending to the person. So you should look to the reward, mainly in the next life, but also be prepared that to do things to please God, not to please ourselves. So if the good costs you nothing, you shouldn't be paid for doing it. Usury is properly the taking of money for a loan or use of anything over and above what pays for its wear and tear. Such use involving no care or labour on the part of the lender. And we've gone there. I mentioned it later. Now, Napoleon is the other main thing. I was staying at the Union Jack Club, Waterloo. I have an office I'm working in Waterloo. Now, the issue of Waterloo is very important, that Napoleon had, by the Battle of Waterloo, had already abolished interest as the basis of France's economy. He had converted to Islam in 1798, taking the name Ali Bonaparte. And the battle throughout the history that he could have actually had peace at any time had he agreed to surrender his decision to abolish interest. The Jewish rabbis in 1809 abolished interest with the full agreement, and they stamped a medal in his honour for liberating them from the Lateran Council. So Napoleon, what we've read about Napoleon, and James Gibbs Stuart, who is sitting here, translated this book, which I managed to get, Napoleon and Islam, published in 1914, all his archives, in which his agreement with Goethe, Tipu Sultan, all the stuff you cannot find in the standard works on Napoleon is in this book, and James Gibbs Stuart spent 2 years translating it. Brilliant. Now, Napoleon understood this, and he said when he saw the debt of France, as Tariq has been talking about, and Peter, we saw the debt, he said, the deadly facts herein reveal that it is amazing that this monster interest has not devoured all humanity. It would have done so long ago had not bankruptcy and revolution, terrorism, violent revolution, acted as counterpoisons. All previous empires, including that of Rome, were destroyed owing to the sinister influence of moneylenders. McNair Wilson, in his book on Napoleon, declared that it cannot be too strongly insisted that finance and not territorial aggrandizement is the key to understanding Napoleon's reign. Had the French emperor consented to abandon his financial system in favour of the system of London, that is, in favour of the loans by the money market, he could have had peace at any time. So, understand, war is an inevitable consequence because the system, satanic purses, we campaigned in Bradford in the election on satanic purses, and people like that. And Geoffrey Mark, in this brilliant book, The New Idolatry, The Pathology of Debt, and he points out that the same thing about Napoleon, said people fight for their interests, not for their rights. And this was the point that we were making. Now, this is the point that Marx made in 1934. And by the way, Karl Marx also understood that there are two kinds of capitalists: the worker, who is a capitalist, and also the renter of money, and both are in mortal conflict. You've got to get to volume three. So Marx didn't condemn all capital or capitalism. He just condemned that which was usurious and that which belonged or allowed people to control others through money. This traffic in the money commodity is the true and sinister function of international finances and the heads of central banks, whether they realize it or not. It is this trafficking and usury's emphasis on it which has brought about the progressive decline of money as a medium of exchange, which is its true and which should be its only function. Now remember this point, because Imam Ghazali identified that in the 12th century, and we can say amen to that. Now, long before Ricardo Smith, Lincoln, Marx, and of course Keynes, as our colleague was mentioning this morning, the betrayal of Keynes was taken because what he suggested was correct, that we should issue money as the Bradbury was issued by John Bradbury in 1914 at the outbreak of war, who dissented in many of the committees that were held after that. And basically, Keynes said all money should come into existence at zero or as close to zero interest as possible. And this is important, that Keynes' system of deficit spending was hijacked by the system. And to talk about Arthur Scargill or the NUM, I met Arthur Scargill and during the miners' strike, and I said, where is your money today, Arthur? He said, it's in the City of London. I said, and they're supposed to be your enemies. How do you know where they know where all your money is and everything? So the point is that we still suck with the devil, but we don't have a long enough school. So this point is that, now this is Imam Ghazali, remember what Ruskin just said, now this is Ghazali, 12th century. The creation of dirhams and dinars, money, is one of the blessings of Allah. They are, however, to be looked on as stones having no intrinsic value, i.e. no usual fertility or utility. For all human beings need them, because everybody needs a large number of commodities for his eating, wearing, etc. And often he does not have what he needs, and does have what he needs not. Therefore, the transactions of exchange are inevitable. But there must be a measure on the basis of which price can be determined, because the exchange commodities are neither of the same type nor of the same measure, which can determine how much quantity of one commodity is a just price for another. Therefore, all these commodities need a mediator to judge their exact value. Allah Almighty has therefore created dirhams and dinars, units of money, as judges and mediators between all commodities, so that all objects of wealth are measured through them. Okay? And these being the measure of the value of all commodities is based upon the fact that they are not intended to be an objective in themselves. Had they been an objective in themselves, one could have a specific purpose for keeping them, which might have given them more importance according to his intention, while the one who has no such purpose would not have given them such importance, and thus the whole system would have been disturbed. As we've just seen now, this recent collapse has been happening periodically since 1720. The history, as you see, of England has been, and Kondratiev's curve is a 7-year cycle, repeating cycle.
15.
It's 7, and 7 times 7.
Kondratiev's.
15. No, it's 7 as in Jubilee, then as in Lagash in Sumeria, from 2400 BC, debt was cancelled in the 7th year, automatically. Whether you lent or borrowed in the 7th year, you must write it off. The Bible then, the Israelites, then enshrined that. This is enshrined in the Mosaic Law. In the 7th year, all debt is written off. Whether you contract the debt in the 6th year, you must write it off and write it off as sadaka, charity. So Kondratiev mirrors that. It is not a trade cycle, it's the interruption with the money that causes the trade cycle. What we are supposed to accept, that the windmills create the wind and the waving of the trees cause the breeze. So economics is about the management of scarcity, which we don't have. So this issue of the money that Ghazali is pointing out, so the one who owns them, i.e. the money, dirhams and dinars, is as if he owns everything, unlike the one who owns a piece of cloth, because he who owns only a piece of cloth, if he needs food, the owner of the food might not be interested in exchanging his food for the piece of cloth, because he may need an animal, for example. Therefore, there was needed a thing which in its appearance is nothing, but in its essence is everything. The thing which has no particular form may have different forms in relation to other things, like, for example, a mirror, which has no colour, but it reflects all colour. The same is the case of money. It has not an it is not an objective in itself, but it is an instrument that leads to all objectives. Anybody disagree? 1200? Brilliant. So the one who is using money in a manner contrary to its basic purpose is in fact disregarding the blessings of Allah. Consequently, whoever hoards money is doing injustice to it and is defeating there and its natural purpose. He is like the one who detains a ruler in prison, unless it's Saddam Hussein, and whoever effects the transactions of interest on money is in fact discarding the blessings of Allah and is committing injustice, because money is created for some things, not for itself. So the one who has started trading in money itself has made it an object contrary to the original wisdom behind its original creation, because it is an act of injustice to use money for a purpose other than the one it was created for. If it is allowed for him to trade in money itself, money will become his ultimate goal and will remain detained like hoarded money, and imprisoning a ruler or restricting the postman from conveying the message is nothing but injustice. So the money allows us to transfer, without interest, basically we have to understand that Ruskin was telling us this, and the Bible and all the scholars throughout history have been telling us the same thing, but man is in most things contentious. He wants to have editorial control. And we've had the failures now. This is This is, we had the one in the 30s, but as George Soros says, the current financial crisis could be worse than the 30s, but we have brought it upon ourselves. And the solution is, when all else fails, read the instructions. We've been trying to fix the machine. In Sheffield, this is a saying, when we get a new machine, and everybody's so arrogant, we know how the CNC works and how everything works. But after about 5 days, night shift waiting for the machine, say, okay, read the instructions. So this, our problem is, we've got to read the instructions, which are very important. This is the National Bank of England model by David Ricardo, 1823. Abraham Lincoln implements Ricardo's model for his greenback dollar in 1685, and he was, of course, as soon as he made his declaration, the marvellous declaration, in which the punchline is that democracy will rise superior to the money power, like J.F. Kennedy, who had done the same thing 5 months before they got him, he would have prevented the escalation of war, because war, as Rhodes said, we no longer wage war for dynastic reasons, but simply because it is good business. Right, I know I'm coming to the end of my... Now, this is what Ruskin was saying, we've already gone through that. Now, the proof that war is a concomitant of interest is predicted by Silvio Gesell, who had already, by Austria adopting his model in 1932, had solved unemployment, but the Bush family and the Bank of England decided that Austria wanted the Bush Award for architecture. Now, in Zeitung am Mittag, on the eve of them signing the peace declaration, the armistice, Silvio Gesell published this article in Zeitung am Mittag, which, and I don't think anybody can argue the fact that what he said, in spite of the holy promises of people to banish war once and for all, and in spite of the cry of millions never again war, in spite of all the hopes for a better future, I have this to say. If the present monetary system based on interest and compound interest remains in operation, I dare to predict today that it will take less than 25 years for us to have another new and even worse war. I can foresee the coming developments clearly. The present degree of technological advancement will quickly result in a record performance of industry. The buildup of capital will be rapid in spite of the enormous losses during the war, and through its oversupply, because of its oversupply, they will lower the interest rate. That's what it should read. Money will then be hoarded. Economic activities will diminish, and increased numbers of unemployed persons will roam the streets. Within these discontented masses, while revolutionary ideas will arise, and also with it, the poisonous plant called supranationalism will proliferate. No country will understand the other, and the end can only be war again. Because of interest, expect war from God, whether you're believers or not believers. For Muslims, now this is the article in The Guardian, 25th of September, how Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise to power. This is a very important article. This is a Bradbury, Malaysian monetary crisis. Professor Ken Palmerton, Mohammed Rafiq, James Gibb Stewart, and a number of others who worked. I took the plan that they designed. Mahathir implemented it. And we defeated the IMF and George Soros. And I met George Soros' men in India a month ago, and they were boasting how well they'd done in Thailand. I said, what about Malaysia? Nothing. So, now, this is, just quickly, I'll go through this. This is the Economist in India, and I'll just read you this quickly. Where you find six economists, you're likely to find seven opinions. And in India, this is no exception. Here, just before that, is Montek Singh Ahluwalia, who is the advisor to the Prime Minister, who I gave him a copy of the book that I have written by the House Banking Committee. He said, this is a seditious little book. I said, but this is the government a seditious organization? And he remained silent. But anyway, the Indian and Bengali economists, like the British ones, like Hayek, are all taught from the same book. The IMF sent out six men to Learning Much Inclined to find the cause of inflation, though each of them was blind. The first chanced on an elephant, and happening to fall against its broad and sturdy side that once began to bore, it's clear to me, now everyone, inflation's just a wall. The second feeling round the touch said, no, what have we here so very round and smooth and sharp? To me it's mighty clear, this thing we call inflation is called by something like a spear. The third approached the animal, and happening to take its squirming trunk within its hands, his hands thus boldly up and spake, with me, said he, you must agree, inflation's but a snake. The fourth reached out his eager hand and felt around the knee. What most this wondrous beast be like, it's mighty plain to me, 'tis clear enough, inflation's caused by something like a tree. The fifth who chanced to touch the ear said, even the blindest man cannot deny inflation's caused by something like a fan. The sixth no sooner had begun around the beast to grope, and seizing on its swinging tail, this foolish well-paid dope said, tea, with me you must agree inflation's but a rope. Whilst these servile sons of mammon exercise their banker's minds, and their puerile information fills the columns of the Times, they debate this thorny question, they debate it loud and long, and whilst each was partly in the right, their conclusion sure were wrong. Shalom, peace be with you. Salaam alaikum.
Thank you very much for that, Dawood. Great insights, and thank you for making the powerful connection between the debt-based usury system and war. It's one of the themes of today, and you've shown the threads in history where that is a reality and which could repeat itself and will repeat itself unless we change, as you mentioned. Now, we, because of the early hiccups, technical and otherwise, those who've been here since the beginning, you know, we've had some amazing presentations, passion, vision. That's what I said this event would be, and alhamdulillah, you know, we're getting there. Now, I think we need a break. But it'll be a short break because this event, you know, we've got to maximize every minute. So please have a cup of tea for our mobiles. Should be and must be switched off. It's been televised. Okay, let's move on. Onwards and upwards. Now, the next session, I know it's been one-way traffic so far, but we're moving towards a Q&A after the session. About, you know, half an hour. You might cut it short, but we'll see. And, you know, at the end of the event, we've got 1 hour of Q&A. So, you know, there's opportunities to interact. Okay, the next speaker is Dr. Mohammed Hassan. He is a research consultant, he's an academic, and he's also written a book, well, several books or many articles on globalization and the recolonization of the Muslim world. And, you know, as an international Islamic think tank, we obviously also want to see what is the state of the Muslim world. On the one hand, people talking about all that money out there, you know, Gulf money, but what are the actual realities of the people who are called terrorists, you know, by those who are terrorizing the world, and those who control the global financial system. And so Dr. Mohammed Hassan is one of Global Vision's, you know, associates. Over to you, Mohammed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohit. Ladies and gentlemen, in this short time, I would just highlight few bits and pieces on this issue. And before that, I apologize that I have very bad throat, so just please tolerate me if there is any problem. Right, in this issue, what I believe is that the problem of underdevelopment, it creates many, many problems. Whether it is a violence or instability or human deprivation, so there are many forms of it. That's why I chose this topic today for discussion, particularly with reference to Muslim world. If you look at this map, I mean, all the green areas over here. In this part, the Muslim population is over 50%, and it's estimated that around the members of OIC, Organization of Islamic Conference, they constitute around 29% of global area-wise, I mean, and demographically, Muslim constitute around 23% of total world's population. concept of human development, I would say human development rather than underdevelopment. The reason is that this concept was presented by the United Nations Development Program, UNDP, in 1990. And since then, they publish a report, human development report, every year. And then they rank all countries of the world with respect to the value of a human development index, which is based mainly on per capita income, life expectancy, and literacy rate of various countries. And here, in this presentation, I tried to make a sort of comparison between Muslim countries and non-Muslim countries. Here, with regard to this human underdevelopment situation, if you see the comparison, I mean, high-income countries and low-income countries. Say, in high-income countries, I took two countries, New Zealand and UAE, and in low-income countries, Vietnam and Guinea, a Muslim country. You will see here that their GDP or income is the same, New Zealand and UAE, and the same Vietnam and Guinea. But the difference you can see, particularly in the literacy rate, there is a huge, huge difference, and due to which the value of human development index is, I mean, there's a lot of difference. New Zealand is on 19th position in the world as compared to UAE, which is on 41st position. Similarly, Vietnam on 108th position and Guinea 156th position. So this is the difference, and you can imagine the difference between Muslim and non-Muslim countries which have same level of income, but they are still underdeveloped as compared to their non-Muslim counterparts. One of the major problem, as it is already discussed in the previous presentations, that the difference between have and have not is increasing day by day. If you look at this chart, in 1900, the difference between average GDP per capita, poor countries and rich countries of the world, the ratio was 1:7. But this ratio increased in 1992. This rose to 1:72. So this is another problem, that when rich are getting more and more richer as compared to and the poor, they are getting poorer. The debt situation. Again, I would say that if you take two groups of countries, Jordan and Philippines, just for example, Tunisia and Romania, same level of income in this group, Jordan and Philippines, exactly, with very minor difference. Also in case of Tunisia and Romania, the same level of income. But their HDI index is different, and also the main thing is here, the debt burden. These countries, I mean, look at the Jordan and also Tunisia, they have nearly double level of debt burden as compared to their non-Muslim counterpart. And this is in spite of the fact that they have the same level of income. Who controls this world's business? I tried to compare the data of 1990 and 2004. In these 5 years, there are two or three things to be noticed here. The sales of major multinational corporations, which are owned by America or Europe, their sale increased to 9% in these 5 years. But as compared to this, look at their profit, nearly 100%, double profit they earned. And also the assets, 26 or 27%. How they earned this huge profit, I mean, it went very, very, I mean, at high rate. And why they accumulated so much assets, what were the ways and means? You know it and I know it. Profit of trade. Again, if you look at the trade situation of Muslim countries and non-Muslim countries, I try to compare low-income Muslim and non-Muslim countries here. Again, in these five years, the export growth rate in Muslim countries, low-income Muslim countries, was 4%. Non-Muslim countries, the figure was nearly 9%. But when you say the balance of trade, the Muslim countries are major loser. Military expenditure of top 10 countries of the world. This also created a big trouble in the world. Here in the table you can see two scenarios. One is total expenditure, top 10 countries of the world, and other per capita expenditure. Again, in both situations, United States is on the top. Look at its defense budget. Although you can say that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait are also there, but if you look at the situation of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, they are the only buyers of American weapons, so they are not producing anything. Due to their troubles, they are forced to buy these weapons. Comparison of military expenditure, power of Israel versus Syria and Iran, and India versus Pakistan. Again, look at the situation. Total defense budget in million, and defense expenditure per soldier. This term, defense expenditure per soldier, it normally, or very vaguely, it highlights the quality of the military of a country. When you compare this Israel's budget, I mean total defense expenditure, and compare it with the combined budget of Syria and Iran, there is no comparison, I would say. Similarly, the defense expenditure per soldier, the quality of Israeli soldiers, and the expenditure in case of Syria and Iran. Again, no comparison. The similar situation can also be seen in case of India and Pakistan. But still, unfortunately, on global media, these both countries are considered axis of evil, and Pakistan is considered troublemaker. And these countries, Israel and India, they are labeled as the world's best democracies in their region. Why this type of situation prevails in the world? What I would say that main reason is that major global players, they have their own interests. They want to control on world's resources everywhere. In this map, you can see that in Gulf, in this region, and also nowadays in Central Asia, there's a lot of oil reserves. And these areas are also troubled areas of the world. But in addition to this, this Pakistan-Afghanistan border, now there's a lot of troubles going on, particularly in tribal areas of Northwest Frontier Province, and also in the province of Balochistan. Why? The reason is that there is huge reserves of oil, and they are not explored yet. So they have their own agendas, redrafting of the global map. And maybe some of you have seen the maps on internet, because their future plan and some of the material they have published as a training manuals as well in United States for their military, they have their new maps of the regions. Like Pakistan will lose this whole Northwest Frontier province to Afghanistan. And then Balochistan province and also parts of Iran, they will create a new state according to their own agendas. Why? Because, as I mentioned, that there are a lot of oils and they want to grab those resources. And then they apply double standard to promote their agenda. Here I try to compare the situation of Kashmir with East Timor. Sorry, I have bad score. Look at the situation, Kashmir. Again, I would say there is no comparison of population, Kashmir and East Timor, such a tiny state. Area-wise, again, there is a huge difference. Dominant religion in Kashmir, Islam, and East Timor, Christianity. Occupied by, this is the real and major point and difference, I would say. Occupied, Kashmir is occupied by a non-Muslim country. East Timor was occupied by a Muslim country, Indonesia. And Kashmir was occupied in 1947, very old issue. East Timor, a very new issue as compared to Kashmir. There are 19 resolutions on Kashmir to solve this problem in accordance with the United Nations resolutions. But no one bothered about that, because major global players, they don't want that. There were only two resolutions on East Timor, and then they took immediate actions, and then they resolved the problem within a couple of years. So this is the way. And then they also utilized the United Nations for their own interests. You can look at this situation in another perspective as well. Here, look, East Timor, the annual budget, and then compare it with the India-Pakistan, the Kashmir issue, military observer group in India and Pakistan. Is there any comparison between this budget, 8.3 million and 584 million? Absolutely no, I would say. And then, this is the oldest issue. And that is the most new issue, East Timor. But they wanted it and they have done that. Unfortunately, this type of situation leads to when there are global hegemonic agendas, this type of situation leads to violence and disturbance. And this is the reason possibly they want it on some areas of the world. They create economic deprivation through debt burden, increasing debt burden, and several other things, as it has been discussed in earlier speeches as well. And these socio-economic disparities leads to violence and reactionary element. And when there is a violence and trouble, then it is a golden opportunity for them to sell their arms. And then when there is more arms sale in that troubled region, both violence and arms sales, they promote each, support each other, and there is more and more troubles. And this is the reactionary element, violence, and then it also leads to terrorism. And we see nowadays what's going on in this world. And then when this type of troubles are there, then they say this is a clash of civilization and it is a natural phenomenon. I would say that this type of clash of civilization, it's a very new phenomenon. Why it was not 50 years before or 30 years before? Why it's new? I mean, why they mentioned this clash in 1990s? But maybe, again, there are some other things. Look at these two American gentlemen, Francis Fukuyama and Samuel Huntington. In his thesis, End of the History and the Last Man, and in and his book, Clash of Civilization and Remaking of World Order. If you go, I mean, the points, the essence of their research is, according to Francis Fukuyama, Western liberal values will dominate all over the world and the days of Islam are over. But when we think on this situation, that only Western values will dominate the world and every other thing will be vanished, particularly the Islamic values and the days of Islam are over, how the humanity will get benefit from this type of situation? Honestly speaking, what I believe is Francis Fukuyama is totally silent on this issue. Absolutely, he don't say anything. But what next? He stops here, and Samuel Huntington, he starts from this point. In his thesis, he says that end of the history is the beginning of wars between civilizations. And which civilizations? Ultimately, in his view, there will be two centers of power. One, West, and other, the rest. In the rest, there are two main civilizations which are threat to the West. One is Chinese civilization in general, and Muslim civilization in particular. And again, you can think that what is Muslim civilization? I mean, they don't talk about race or other things or geographic or demographic aspects. So, according to his philosophy, this Muslim civilization is based on faith, while Chinese civilization is based on faith. Again, there are some sort of double standard and contradictions. So, according to Huntington, this Islam or Muslim civilization is the major and particular threat to Western values. Again, if you focus on the essence of their what they want to say, but sometimes they don't say it clearly. Indirectly, they try to highlight those points. Francis Fukuyama's main worry is declining human capital in the West, like the aging population in the West. So, proportion of young people is decreasing in this in the West. And Samuel's Huntington's worry is that rising human capital in the Muslim world, proportion of young people is very high in the Muslim world. But as I mentioned, that there is a huge difference, income difference, and other problems between West and the rest. So there is a lot of migration from rest to West, particularly from Muslim world to the Western world. And especially the young Muslims, when they migrate to the West, so this is their main worry, the rising migration of young people from the Muslim world to the West. So both are agree. So this is the real essence of their research. So this is the one point on which they try to highlight. But unfortunately, they never propose any solution that what are the reasons for this? Why these people are migrating to West? And what are the solutions of those? No, they are totally silent, rather than they promote some other fake views. And possibly, this is also the sort of their program to control over the resources of all over the world, I would say. And this is the mechanism of their control. Through international finance, international trade, information and technology, science and technology, and media. This international finance is mainly controlled by World Bank and IMF, international trade through WTO and multinational corporations, and science and technology, of course, and the media is global media. And then control over global political economy in general and Muslim world in particular. There are many solutions many people can propose, but what I think is that one of the most important solution of this problem is that, as I mentioned earlier, that when there is an underdevelopment or poverty or deprivation, it itself is the causes of many, many problems. So what I would say that Muslim countries need to focus and they need to resolve their own problems. They won't get any help from Western world or some other major global world. So they have to think about this. In my book, I try to highlight this program from now, from 2011 to 2050, a three-phase plan. And very brief outline of this is, first phase, just in 2-3 minutes I'll finish. First one is that from 2011 to 2020, in this period, main focus should be reorganizing of OIC, and then within that framework, the promotion of intra-Ummatic, intra-Muslim world cooperation, particularly the economic cooperation, promoting trade between Muslim countries. So when they will have this economic incentive, so there will be, I mean, this will be the first step for that. And then there are some other points as well. Promotion of science and technology, and also establishment of a strong media. But as there are a lot of troubles within the Muslim world, some are, you can say, indigenous and some are imposed from outside, they must establish a Muslim Security Council, I would say, so that they should resolve their problem by themselves. In the second phase, most of the emphasis should be on the emerging economies and establishment of a joint foreign policy. So, to some extent, this is on the lines of the European Union, although not exactly, but to some extent, it's like this. And then they need to establish, I mean, some other new institution and promotion of coordination between various institutions within the Muslim countries. And in addition to this, in addition to Muslim Security Council, they also need to establish a Muslim Defense Force. And when there's a problem in Iraq or Afghanistan, they don't need to invite NATO or allied forces because there are more troubles. And maybe you have seen, watched on television that there are some forces, UAE military in Afghanistan, and they are doing very well. So I would say that if this type of approach is applied totally as a whole, it can produce a better results. And similarly, the last third phase is that at the end of this stage, there should be a unified currency and a common defense, a joint foreign policy, and a very strong intercommunication network. And by the end of this 2050, this organization should be a Muslim governing body. And this is just a chart that under this framework, OIC, there are the need to establish some new institutions and also to strengthen the existing one. But one and last question is that someone may ask that how would you finance this such a huge organization and many other these activities? I tried to make some calculations. What I believe is that if Muslim countries start to contribute 0.01% of their GDP to the common pool, and then they increase it to 1% in 10 years, then in these 10 years, they can accumulate $120 billion. And on average basis, if you look at this figure, then around $12 billion, I think that's enough to bring a positive change in the Muslim, not only in the Muslim world, but when they will be strong, it will be helpful for global peace and prosperity. I think that's all in this short time. Thank you very much for your
Thank you, Mohammed. It's important to get facts on the Muslim world. You know, you get all these images, all this money, you know, of one section, you know, of the Muslim world, you know, the Gulf sheikhs. But, you know, he's pinpointed on various realities. But underpinning it all is really banking, actually, money, debt. You know, we need to keep on coming back to that because that's the underlying theme. Connecting East and West, you know, what's really happening with the money and who controls the money. Now, now we're going to have some powerful solutions. I'm not saying the last one wasn't solution-based. I mean, there's always a mix of diagnosis and prescription. I'm pleased to have on stage Sajjad Khan representing Hizb al-Tahrir. For those who don't know Arabic, Hizb means Party, Tahrir Liberation. They are one of the world's, not just UK, largest Islamic political parties. They have had some bad press, you know, obviously in a context of war, you know, so-called global war on terror, where the West is on the onslaught, demonization. Certainly non-violent. He's on the executive committee, and also he has been an editor of New Civilization magazine. And he'll be speaking on the need for new blocks, basically. Sajjad, welcome.
Thank you, Mohi. Welcome to everyone here. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. I think we've heard some very interesting, stimulating, powerful presentations during the course of the day, and I think if we all think that the current financial crisis is the worst case, then I think we're in for a rude awakening. At the moment, what we've seen is some problem in the subprime area, which compared to some of the other toxic areas of the financial system is like a teddy bear's picnic. We haven't seen the credit default swaps market, the problems there. We haven't seen the problems in the structured finance market, in the leverage market. Carlyle Group, as some of you already know, its main subsidiary in Europe is effectively close to bankruptcy, liquidity problems, because it was borrowing at astonishing levels of leverage, $22 for every dollar of equity. And that kind of leverage is not just specific to Carlyle, it is permeated through the whole system, even to the extent that organisations like the Co-op, hardly a bastion of right-wing neoliberal thinking, has had to make a write-down on its own financial accounts because of investments in some of these toxic assets. So what we're actually seeing is a whole domino effect starting from subprime, but will extend to other areas of the market. So when people say that we are actually in this room, people in this room are scaremongering, you know, we're peddling scare stories. We're trying to put fear into the minds of people. That's the kind of environment we should push back on, because it isn't fear-mongering what we're doing. The people in Indonesia and Thailand who can't afford to buy staples like rice, that isn't fear-mongering. The people who owned stock in Bear Stearns, who saw their company go from $17 billion to nothing overnight, it isn't fear-mongering. The people who have lost their jobs and their first houses because people on Wall Street wanted their third and fourth houses, isn't fear-mongering. So we are actually on the precipice of probably more problems over the next few months, and the next 6 months, and the next 9 months. And what we're seeing is the solutions being peddled is more of the same. You know, the idea that this is a regulatory failure, that the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve were asleep at the switch. This is the story now being pushed, that we need more regulation. The naivety is that the regulators provide the political and legal cover for exactly the type of things that have been going on for the last decade and the last century. Securitization and leverage have been promoted as risk mitigation by the regulators. Low interest rates are a weapon that they use, but it is a weapon that doesn't address the fundamental problem. And asking for more regulation, as Hank Paulson was doing last week, the ex-CEO of Goldman Sachs, who's now the Treasury Secretary in the Bush administration, is asking for more regulation, more power to be given to the Federal Reserve, the very body that has no accountability, that is not elected, and doesn't even answer to the US state, to give them even more power. This is the agenda we're moving towards. So I want to widen this topic out to more issues around where we think we're heading internationally. Because this crisis, though designed in Wall Street, built in Wall Street, and implemented from Wall Street, has affected every street in the world. And the US, who 232 years ago, the founding fathers, began a journey with some self-evident truths, that self-evident truths has spawned an ideology that, despite its multiple contradictions, has led the United States from effectively being a nation of farmers to being the world's only superpower. Yet this era now of superpower, of a unipolar world, is over. The US has been exposed as the latest emperor with no clothes. As most empires, it overextended. Debt became addictive. Greed overtook fairness. And what we have seen on Wall Street and Main Street is excess. And so what we are now witnessing is the United States economically, militarily, and politically falling from that lofty position. Economically, we see it. The debt, the dollar is tanking. You know, I read an interesting newspaper article that immigrants now are refusing to go to the United States and instead choosing to go to the Eurozone or Canada because the US dollar is so pathetic at holding its value that when they actually convert it back into their domestic currencies, they're actually losing money. So the US dollar, the world's reserve currency, is now being viewed by even immigrants as something short of a joke. Militarily, we know that Iraq has led to the US military actually being exposed as not being able to be even dealing with an asymmetric conflict. And you would have thought after Vietnam that they would have done. But because of the military-industrial complex, who prefer to sell smart bombs and laser-guided weapons to the United States at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars, the United States has no business model, operating model, whatever you want to call it, to deal with the asymmetric paradigm shift that we see in the world today. And politically, despite what we're seeing in the US presidential campaign, the special interests are still backing both sides. You know, this is going to be the first billion-dollar presidential campaign. Billions of dollars for senators, for House races, all being provided by those special interests. Nothing's going to change in Washington in January 2009. So while the US will remain one of the leading powers, it will not be the leading power. What we have now seen is a growth in other centers of influence and centers of power. As political thinkers since Pericles have taken note, distinction breeds envy, envy breeds resentment, and unchecked, resentment breeds hatred. And that's what we're seeing in this US-dominated world. And what we are actually seeing is these new blocs, China, Russia, India, the Muslim world, that are going to start to emerge and are starting to emerge and are going to start to challenge the status quo. And some people say that's dangerous, that a unipolar world at least gives you stability. It doesn't lead to conflict, like they say, for example, happened before the First World War. That is nonsense. What we've actually seen is more instability since the United States became the single most dominant nation. And what you're seeing is more wars, more conflict, more occupation. So what we're actually seeing is more instability in the unipolar world. And in this emerging system, we're going to see paradigm shifts in alliances. You know, Palmerston's dictum, no permanent friends, permanent enemies, permanent interests. So what you're going to actually see is a paradigm shift in different alliances emerging, old alliances being strained. And that's what we've got to review, because there are fundamental trends affecting the world, not just economy, but demography, resources, military trends, and emergence of new ideologies. And I just want to touch on these briefly. Demography, or the study of demographics, is a very interesting scenario. Historically, we were told that if a nation expanded its birth rate, it was doomed. Malthusian economics. But that is actually not the case. What we're seeing is those nations that have scale and huge markets are becoming the leading nations. China, India. These are countries that have the biggest populations in the world. And the problem is not a high population. The problem is inequalities, distribution of resources, and I'll come to that in a minute. We're seeing a very, very critical debate about immigration in the West. The West is putting up the walls against immigration, even though it wants access to everyone else's markets in the third world. On resources, the critical issues of food, which we thought was not going to be a problem. Food was so widely available. But yet what we're seeing over recent years is speculators entering into the food derivatives markets. And that's why you're seeing the prices of corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, all jumping, you know, doubling in price over recent years, because the speculators are now buying ETFs, exchange-traded funds. They're buying derivative instruments which have no physical ownership of the commodity, but are driving the prices up in the world markets. And these kinds of resources are going to be critical. Military protection, the ability to defend yourself and to promote your interests, is going to be key. And the last point about ideologies. The previous speaker mentioned Fukuyama. And this is a critical point, because as the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs says, actually democracy is in recession. We're actually seeing some new ideologies that are challenging pseudo-liberal capitalism. Whether it's authoritarian capitalism in China or in Russia, or populist capitalism in some parts of Latin America, what you're actually seeing is some variant alternatives, but they're actually not challenging the fundamental contradictions of capitalism. The Islamic ideology, which is controversial, so let me just tell you a little about it. Whereas capitalism judges how successful a society is by its GDP, Islam judges a society by how many poor there are in society. Whereas capitalism prioritizes the production of wealth, Islam prioritizes the distribution of wealth. Whereas capitalism favors income and expenditure taxes, Islam articulates wealth taxes. And that's very interesting, because most of the rich people in this world convert their wealth from income to capital to evade income taxes. They put money in all sorts of different financial models to evade taxation from being incurred. And Islam actually specifically says we don't tax income, we tax wealth. Because wealth separates income and from expenditure. We're not going to punish people because they have to have significant expenditures. We're going to tax the surplus wealth. And if you look at the world scenario today, most nations don't even give aid according to 0.7% of the GDP, the UN target. Most countries like America and Britain haven't even met that target. Islam says 2.5% of your wealth will be given in zakat to be distributed to the poor. Whereas modern day capitalism insists on fiat currencies, Islam favours sound monetary policy via the gold standard. And where capitalism allows natural resources to be owned by private interests, Islam insists that they're owned on behalf of the public. Where capitalism enjoins speculation and short-selling, Islam prohibits this kind of activity. And what you're actually seeing now is a difference. Hillary Clinton, for example, yesterday stood up in the morning and said she's going to elect a poverty czar in her cabinet if she wins. By the end of the day, she declared her tax returns, $109 million over the last 7 years, her and her husband earned, if earned is the right word here, $109 million over the last 7 years. So actions speak larger than words, and no wonder with this kind of gulf and this kind of program, tens of millions have joined Hizb-ut-Tahrir in the Muslim world by calling for such a system. Now, these other nations, China, Russia, India, they're making the same mistakes. They're making the same mistakes. If you look at the inequality in China and India, and you look at the inequality in the West, you see a lot of similarities. India can be very proud of its IT sector, but you just walk a few blocks down the road in Bangalore or in Delhi, and you see real poverty on the streets of India. India cannot gain its prosperity in the world by imitating the mistakes it has seen before in the United States and in the West. The Muslim world, as the previous speaker said, is home to most of the world's energy resources, most of the world's oil and gas. It has a significant and rising population. It has a unifying ideology of Islam. Its main problem is political disunity, poor leadership, and occupation. And unlike the previous speaker, I don't think we can wait till 2050.
Yeah.
I don't think the Muslim world at the current rate could be around in 2050. The Muslim world is being systematically attacked in the media. And let's just be very, very clear about the global media. We need a paradigm shift there. Whereas democracy is linguistically translated as the rule of the majority, some people translate it as the rule of the mob. And the mob in today's scenario, today's paradigm, isn't the people in Rome in the Colosseum putting their thumbs up and their thumbs down. It's the media, the global media, that so poisons most of positive discussion, poisons the debate around immigration. Look at what the reaction was to the House of Lords report on immigration this week. And you see some of the facets of this discussion. Islamic world is being attacked by the media, it's being attacked by physically by the armies that are hosting in Baghdad, in Kabul. And what you're actually seeing is an attack on Islam, not because of its social model. We can agree or disagree about Islam's social model. But look at the economic model that Islam provides, the agenda that I have set out, the strength and stability that will be brought about by a unified Islamic world. And you can see why even the CIA in its 2020 report, which it released in 2004, warned about this new caliphate that would emerge. And they are already preparing for it, and they are already preparing their attacks as we are witnessing day by day. So we are moving towards a multipolar world. Russia, India, the European Union. We are seeing the Muslim world emerging. And this multipolar world will eventually spawn a new paradigm in international relations. We can't have the post-1945 paradigm of international bodies. The IMF, the United Nations, the World Trade Organization. These are remnants of the old paradigm. We are going to need new institutions. Instead of a United Nations which is dominated by five veto-carrying powers, we're going to need a new cooperative of nations, where nations are treated equally, not by nations that have the highest military budgets and a veto at the Security Council. A new world that is shaped by the rising powers that will create new rules for a new international game. We are therefore entering a paradigm, a new paradigm in international relations. No longer will the Fed in Washington call the shots. No longer is the US dollar going to reign supreme. No longer is G.I. Joe going to be feared. What started with self-evident truths in Philadelphia 232 years ago has now morphed into self-evident greed on Wall Street. Today we're going to herald a new dawn where the success of capitalism is finally exposed as the mirage it always was. Thank you very much.
That's hairy stuff. Got vision certainly there. Interesting, Sajjad mentioned Muslim nations being attacked by armies. As we speak here today, there's a massive conference taking place at Romania, NATO, I think. And one of the key decisions was Bush et al. Wanting a fund. If you don't want to contribute soldiers, give us your money, you know, give us your money or equipment. So, you know, it's good that we are linking finance with war, because the reality is that's what's happening out there as we speak. Thousands of delegates in that NATO conference. So the gathering here is very, very relevant. Now over to...